The news brought to you live.
Hello, it is Tuesday, April 15th, just past 5 p.m., and you're listening to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3. I'm your host, Jules Bugel, and for the next hour, I'll bring you some news from the grassroots with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Today on the show, McGill is cracking down on pro-Palestine protest, and democracy on campus could be under threat. Montreal's Vietnamese, Laotian, and Cambodian communities are celebrating 50 years since the arrival of the boat people, but say they're more than good refugees. And in case you missed it, a formerly incarcerated Montrealer is trying to form a prisoner's union. We hear more about building solidarity beyond bars. All that to come on the next hour, but first, we're going to be talking about the big news around these parts, which is from McGill University, who last week announced they're cutting ties with their undergraduate student union, more commonly known by its acronym SSMU or SMU, after students took part in a three-day strike for Palestine 2 weeks ago. To help put it into context, we'll be joined live by Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, but first, here's a story I produced last week about the controversial move, and you'll hear all about that before we get into the interview itself. Take a listen. McGill is cutting ties with its undergraduate student society and looking to bar a protest on its campus after a student strike for Palestine last week. It's a move that student society executive Hugo Victor Solomon says threatens student democracy at McGill.
Our job is to represent students. We are representing students. If you don't like what they have to say, don't threaten the system itself.
It all started with an email sent Monday to the campus community. Deputy Provost of Student Life and Learning, Angela Campbell, said McGill was ending the memorandum of agreement with the Student Society at McGill, commonly known through its acronym SSMU or SMU. She cited a three-day strike for Palestine as the cause. The strike was approved in a referendum held by SMU with more than 4,000 students, or 70% of voters, in favor. It was the first student strike on campus in over 20 years.
I'm happy to announce that the motion has been approved.
The strike called on McGill's more than 25,000 undergrads to boycott class and put pressure on the university to cut academic and financial ties with Israel over its war in Gaza, just killed over 50,000 people, mostly women and children. Emails showed that behind the scenes, McGill administration was urging non-compliance from its faculty. Provost Christopher Manfredi told students the day before the strike they would not be entitled to accommodations for any coursework missed, overriding the discretion typically given to professors and TAs. But one of the pro-Palestine groups responsible for last year's encampment, known by its acronym SBHR, encouraged students to go beyond what was written in the strike motion, holding pickets and reporting professors who failed to cancel class. SBHR representative Zaina Karim told CKUT the McGill silence on the war in Gaza pushed student activists to take a stronger stance.
I mean, I think like the restlessness that we feel from like a lot of students on campus is very expected when you see how many times the students have demanded in majority that they want divestment and that they don't want to be complicit through their tuition in a genocide.
Following last year's student encampment for Palestine, McGill's Board of Governors had committed to considering divestment from weapons companies. The committee studying the issue advised against it in February.
I mean, we're talking about companies like Lockheed Martin or Safran. These are like military weapon companies that just profiteer off death. So, you know, when McGill tries to paint this narrative of violent protesters or campus feeling unsafe, I find that really funny considering that they're the ones who allow weapons research to happen in labs in the engineering building.
It was in that same building that a protester smashed the window of Dean of Engineering Vivian Yalcoa's office last Thursday during a rally on day two of the strike. Campbell wrote that the protester used a fire extinguisher filled with red paint and that one staff member was hit by the paint. Solomon says a student was also taken to hospital after being injured by security. CQT was not present to verify those incidents. The following Monday, McGill administration struck back, with Campbell writing that the student union should have ruled the strike motion out of order, and that the strike, quote, divided a campus community already cleaved and hurting. Although the student society had called for a peaceful and voluntary strike, Campbell argued that SMU was ultimately responsible for the actions on campus.
Even though the SSMU put out these two statements, which were incredibly unambiguous in saying, we do not support actions which are violent or obstructionist or against the code of student conduct, the university is still finding us somehow responsible for the actions that were not associated with the mandated strike.
As vice president of external affairs, Solomon was SMU's point person for the strike. He said SMU did everything in its power to keep things peaceful, even sending staff to picket lines to act as mediators. For him, the university's move is less about the way students protested and more about what they were protesting.
I think it's interesting that this incident in particular is being highlighted as a way of undermining why people are protesting. You notice that the word Palestine does not appear a single time in this communication, nor any other communication by the interim deputy provost. And there's a reason for that.
This isn't the first time McGill has threatened cutting ties with SMU. In 2022 and 2023, McGill said they'd terminate the Memorandum of Agreement, or MOA, over pro-Palestine policies passed in student referenda. Then again, in 2024, they threatened termination over the club status of SPHR. The university justified the moves by saying the policies and the student club violated McGill's values of inclusion. In all three cases, the student society ultimately backed down. But Solomon says this time, SMU has learned its lesson.
In previous iterations of the MOA, what was called a default clause could be initiated, where if the administration believed that for whatever reason, the SMU had violated, you know, even the preamble of its constitution, that it could put all of the SSMU's assets in a trust fund if the SSMU did not remedy the alleged default within a number of days. That is no longer the case.
SMU and McGill will enter into a mediation period of 6 weeks. If that fails, clubs lose their right to use the McGill name, and the tenants of the SMU building lose their right to rent. Other student services and the use of student funds will continue. But students looking to voice concern over the termination may have a hard time doing so. On Thursday, McGill's lawyers went in front of a judge to demand an injunction against further protests on campus. In their application, the university writes that as exams are about to begin, there is, quote, a continuous and ongoing need for the reasonable limits that McGill is presently requesting, which include prohibitions on disturbing the peace, intimidating, harassing, or threatening the campus community, blocking access to McGill buildings, or protesting within 5 meters of any building used for McGill. McGill sought and was given a similar injunction after a protest last October 7th ended in broken windows at a trio of university buildings. At the time, the university sought to extend the protest ban past 10 days, but was rejected by the courts. Solomon says that though the student society is facing multiple threats, it has no intention of backing down.
SMU will not be a scapegoat for the university as it continues its campaign to restrict free speech, not just for pro-Palestine supporters, but for anyone wishing to continue the campus legacy of being a space for protest.
A spokesperson for McGill refused to speak for this story. CKUT will follow this as it develops. With additional files from the CKUT News Collective, I'm Jules Bugel with the Local Journalism Initiative.
All right, and we are back live in studio. That was last week's story on McGill's threat to cut ties with its undergraduate student union. To make sense of what's happening at McGill and why everyone should take notice, I'm joined by Jason Toney, Director of Media Advocacy at Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, yeah, I mean, that was a bit of an info dump there in that story. What's your reaction to the news coming out of McGill?
Well, just hearing that story and hearing it all put together like that, first of all, great work. It was very well done. But, it makes your head spin a little bit, just how clearly wrong the administration is, how this is clearly an attack on student freedoms. This is about the criminalization of advocacy for Palestine. And I think students, you know, when they look in the mirror at night, know they're doing the right thing. And this is a very important fight, and it's going on all over the world. I think McGill is unfortunately looking more and more like Columbia University in the U.S. In its own way, but it's sort of becoming the darling of this these tactics of you know, trying to crush dissent, and it's really unfortunate. And I would add a couple of things just very briefly that have sort of come up in recent days that weren't in your story. But on April 12th, I think CTV reported that McGill has filed an injunction against SPHR. And on CBC also recently reported that there's a class action lawsuit being filed by a Montreal law firm and B'nai B'rith that is trying to sue McGill for not doing enough to combat anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. And CJPME actually got access to that case. And it's clearly an effort by a pro-Israel lobby organization to intimidate McGill into cracking down on pro-Palestine activism. So there's a lot going on. It's moving very quickly, but it's an important conversation. So thanks for having me on to talk about this.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe we can look back a little bit at what's been going on at McGill campus, because you mentioned a class action lawsuit, and you know, it's not the first lawsuit we've seen against McGill. For those who don't remember, about this time last year, a little bit later in the year, towards the end of April, McGill students started an encampment on the downtown campus in solidarity with Palestine. And you know, McGill ultimately used private security to dismantle that later in the summer. But up until then, you know, it started out not with McGill trying to get an injunction against protest, but with, you know, students through sort of, I'll just say, legal counsel that takes on a lot of these cases in the city, pursuing this in the courts. And, you know, we've seen again in the story, you might have heard that McGill has threatened terminating this memorandum of agreement in the past. Back in the fall of 2023, when the Student Society SMU passed a policy against genocide in Palestine, you know, it wasn't, I mean, McGill did come down on the Student Society, but it was a private student, now an alumna of the university, who took SMU to court. And, you know, that case is currently being decided on at the appeals level in Quebec. So we've seen not just a lot of activism on McGill campus, but specifically the use of the courts time and time again over what traditionally has been something within the realm of like student politics. What do you think about this? Is this, you know, a new tool that's really come into force since October 7th? Like, I want to hear your take on this.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, it's a longstanding tool, but the extent to which, you know, lawfare is being used now, and the way it's being used shows just how desperate some of these groups that support Israel have become to go ahead and silence dissent on these issues. We keep seeing lawsuit after lawsuit being filed, and they're being filed against not just universities, but even journalists and all sorts of ordinary people. So it goes far and wide. And I think the intention with these kinds of filings and cases are, they're really part of just a larger intimidation tactic to keep people away from speaking about these issues. And I'll also add that CJPME has called on McGill to walk back its decision to revoke the memorandum of agreement with SMU. So I just want to make sure that gets repeated here on air, that we see this as an attack on students and on academic freedom and on student democracy. So I think that's important to add in.
Yeah, and why is it an attack on academic freedom, student democracy? I mean, you know, maybe people are already pretty clear on that if they're listening or have a clearly defined opinion. But in your view, like, what is the specific and most pressing danger about what McGill is trying to do here?
Well, I think the devil's in the details a little bit in this case when it comes to SMU. I mean, I think the SMU representatives who we heard speaking before we started this conversation do a great job of explaining exactly why it's completely ridiculous that they'd be held accountable, much less have the MOA terminated over this. I mean, this was not an action organized by SMU. It was just playing its role in student democracy and just following protocol and did nothing unusual or exceptional. This kind of reaction from the administration is unthinkable in any other context. I mean, this is the Palestine exception in Canada. This is just a classic case of how, when it comes to Palestine, things get treated very differently. And it's obvious why McGill is doing this. It's not just out of fear of all of these lawsuits, which are trying very hard to conflate anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. But, you know, they're trying to protect their investments. There are donors who are putting pressure on them. They have academic partnerships with Israeli universities. So if they let up any ground and, you know, let students win at all in this, they're going to be seen as rolling over by all of these various interests. And it's cowardly. And I think what the students are doing is courageous, and I do think this is a black and white issue that history will view in very clear terms, clear and obvious terms.
Yeah, one thing that Hugo Victor Solomon, who was a SMU rep who we heard from in that story, said to me that didn't make the cut was that, you know, McGill's very proud of itself for its role in South African divestment back in the day. And he felt it was a bit hypocritical for them to take this stance now, given how historically they view that student struggle and McGill's role in it. And, you know, you mentioned the Palestine exception. I've heard this from protesters as well of, well, McGill has taken stances against Russia. They've taken stances against Iran. The administration has done things differently. And they sort of feel that, you know, there is an exception. There is a difference. What are you guys seeing, not just at McGill, but I guess on campuses across Canada? What is the Palestine exception? Is it real? And what does it look like?
Yeah, it's very real. It's very well documented. If you're curious to see how it manifests in media, part of my role at CJPME is running the Media Accountability Project. And we write letters in response to journalists who perpetuate the Palestine exception in the media. But in the context of universities, Concordia has been similarly as awful as McGill. Graham Carr has tried to punish students for trying to pass BDS motions or successfully and democratically passing BDS motions that try to sever ties with Israeli institutions who are complicit in this genocide and just occupation and apartheid more broadly. And when you look across Canada, you know, there are a variety of different approaches that universities have taken. You know, University of Toronto has come down on protesters with a pretty hard hammer, but it doesn't have to be this way, right? There are universities in the US and Canada and in Europe and elsewhere that have divested. They've taken that step. It's possible, right? There's nothing forcing McGill to behave this way. It's a decision. It's a choice that they're making. And sometimes they try to pretend that it's inevitability or they're trying to protect students or any number of arguments they're using against this stuff. But there are enough different examples at universities that this kind of behavior by a university administration is a deliberate decision that, you know, props up the interests of Israel over the interests of its own students, and it's grim.
And, you know, obviously our McGill listeners are going to be caring about the issue, or I would hope that they're going to be caring about the issue if, you know, it's their campus. But for the broader community, why should this matter to them? What's going on college campuses?
Yeah, I mean, I'll cite an example that I think is important, partly because it was in the news a little bit today. Independent Jewish Voices and the Jewish Faculty of Canada against the adoption of IRA, which is a definition of anti-Semitism that conflates anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. These two organizations today came out and called for the resignation of Pascal Derry, who is the Minister of Education in Quebec. And CJPME has called for this minister's resignation as well, because they're investigating professors and students at Dawson and Vanier, if I'm not mistaken, for different Palestine activism, for having content in their syllabi about Palestine. So these issues actually affect not just student democracy, but the actual content that students are able to learn, right? Like, this crackdown is very serious. And for the record, the Minister of Education used to work for CEJA, the Center for Israel here in Canada.
Yeah, the Center for Israeli and Jewish Advocacy,
yes,
I believe.
Yes, thank you.
On the board. She was on
yes,
the board.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And CEJA has bragged about lobbying the minister to take this action. So I think what we're seeing is this is a really widespread phenomena that goes deeper than just student life on campus and actually goes into the content of what students are learning. And I think that's a very serious threat to academic freedom and a threat to our society. And I think that students and campuses have become really the epicenter of resistance to Canadian complicity in Israel's genocide that's going on in Gaza. And it's incredibly important that we do everything we can, whether we agree exactly with every action or statement by students, to protect their right to say these things, because that's really what's at stake here. And I think we're seeing that threat bleed into other areas beyond college campuses, into the press and into other institutions. And I know you want to talk, perhaps if we have a moment, a little bit about the election, but Pierre Poilievre wants to really like put super fuel in these kinds of politics in the way that Trump has in the US. And those kinds of politics are a very real threat to our neighbors, you know, people in our communities who might have temporary status or might be on a student visa, who just want to speak their mind about a very real and pressing issue in the world and could face serious criminal consequences for doing so. So yeah, I think we have to take this all very seriously and not just sort of brush it off as something that doesn't involve us here in Canada, or it's just students. It's, you know, it's a societal issue that needs a serious response, and we need solidarity with students.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you bringing up the election and Pierre Poilievre, because, you know, Palestine is the biggest campus politics issue at McGill. Mm-hmm. And I would say there are definitely other campuses that it's the same. But, you know, in Canada more broadly, in the media, we're in the midst of a federal election campaign, and the urgency just doesn't seem to be there. Is that what you're seeing, you know, this disconnect between what's happening on college campuses and in these activist movements, and then what we're hearing on the nightly news?
Yeah, there's a huge disconnect. And it's not by accident, right? I mean, there is a climate of fear amongst journalists and editors about reporting on these issues, because when they do, they face huge backlash from pro-Israel organizations, whether it's CEJA, like we talked about, or Honest Reporting Canada, which is a multi-million dollar budget dedicated towards, I think it's fair to say, harassing journalists for reporting fairly or in a balanced manner about Palestine. And these media issues inevitably bleed into the conversations we're having during this election. Palestine is just very difficult to get media to bring up. And when they do, you have situations like adversarial if you can call them journalists, at like the Toronto Sun, raising totally unfair questions to candidates, trying to put them in bad situations, or to only answer from one angle. And you had the whole controversy around Carney seeming to acknowledge that there's a genocide going on, which there are so many sources you can draw on at this point that have concluded there is a genocide, or it's plausible genocide, from human rights organizations like Amnesty, or what's going on at the International Court of Justice. And we can't even get them to say the word. And when they do everything they can to walk it back. And it's unfortunate because one of the only people who's really speaking in strong terms about this issue is Poilievre, and his politics are incredibly alarming. If you care about Palestine, you care about freedom of speech, you should be concerned by the rhetoric that he's using when he talks about and the kind of policies that he seems to be keen on implementing as soon as he's in power.
So you're saying basically that, you know, instead of tone policing campus activism, which... you know, sometimes people on the left do it too. It's not just people on the right, but instead of saying, well, these campus activists are making themselves and Palestine activism a threat from people like Poilievre, people should be looking at McGill and saying, we need to be in solidarity with these students, with their activism, with student democracy, because if we're not, we're just letting Poilievre dominate the narrative. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, there's a movement going on right now. An organization has come together called Vote Palestine. And they have a platform online that candidates are signing up for. And that's been really useful for getting candidates on record to talk about this stuff. And this sort of thing is totally unprecedented in past Canadian elections, actually getting politicians on record. And mostly it's members of the Green Party and the NDP who have signed on. But we're seeing more and more liberals sign on to the Vote Palestine platform. And that is incredibly useful. And I think we just need to do everything we can to get politicians on the record talking about this stuff so we can hold them to account.
Yeah, and anybody who's interested can go to cqt.ca. And our news collective, who does Off the Hour on Wednesdays, did a great, great interview on that campaign. But sadly, we're at time. Jason, Tony, thank you so much for coming on CKUT and putting what's happening at McGill into a broader context.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and that was Jason Tony, Director of Media Advocacy at Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. You're listening to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3, and this is our local journalism initiative roundup. Next up, CKUT visited the Centre des Mémoires Montréalaises, also known as the MEM. That museum is around the corner from Place des Arts, and it has a new exhibition. More Than Good Refugees looks back on 50 years of the Boat People and shows some of the many different ways that Montreal's Cambodian, Laotian, and Vietnamese communities have made their impact on the city. We spoke to Amy Ann Nguyen and Maya Tran, two members of the collective Super Boat People, to learn more about the exhibition. Take a listen.
I'm Amy Ann Nguyen. I worked on the exhibition. Yeah, I did the research for it.
I'm Maya Tran. I'm a part of the collective as well. I didn't work actively on the research, but I revised part of the exhibit, and I'm also in Super Boat People. I generally work on food workshops and also literary events.
Tell me about Super Boat People Collective and also where that name came from.
Right. So Super Boat People Collective is a collective of mostly second generation Vietnamese, Lao and Khmer or Cambodian people. Most of us are second generation, so born here from parents who came either as boat people or migrants from those countries. So generally, when we talk about boat people, I think the general public would think of Vietnamese refugees who came by boat. But the people who came by boat weren't only Vietnamese refugees. And people came by boat from Cambodia, from Laos, because of different armed conflicts that were occurring at the time. And the reason why we called it Super Boat People Collective is because we chose to use that superlative super to invite people to think of our communities kind of beyond that dominant narrative.
Can you speak more about I mean, all of these three communities that you're talking about, you know, what you're trying to show about them as this exhibition is marking, you know, the 50th anniversary of 1975, those first arrivals here in Canada?
I think to me, one of the most important things that we try to highlight in general, like in this exhibition, but also in the general like events that we try to organize, is the diversity of our experiences. And that's why it's like Super Boat People. It's not to say that we are not that. It's to say that we are more than just refugees. It's to say that we are also second generation people who have something to say about the future. And I think there is a general recognition of our communities, perhaps more the Vietnamese community, as you say, within this society. But I think the idea is also to kind of reclaim the way that our stories are told. And this exhibition was a lot about telling the story ourselves. And not just telling the story, but telling the stories, and not just focusing those stories on war and displacement and refugeehood, but everything that we've done here since then and everything that we're aspiring to as well. And so I think if you take a look at the exhibition, you'll see that yes, there is a big part of history, but it's also the way that we're writing history today with our different projects, but also with different mobilizations like social campaigns. I don't know if you want to add anything on the exhibit.
I think part of it was also to mark ourselves in the city and to go beyond the fact that we're like a small community or that we only stay together. We really did a lot social-wise. There's organizations that really impacted Montreal beyond just being Asian communities. And for me, this exhibition is also about happiness. That's really stupid to say, but like how life just restarted here for a lot of people, and they found ways to not forget their past, but like just create new projects and continue their life beyond what happened.
Maybe you can tell me a little bit more about the format of the exhibition for people who are interested in attending, and especially because you helped with the research, right? If there's as well anything in what you learned that was surprising or interesting to you, something you think, you know, not enough people know about that you'd like them to come and learn about more.
When you come into the exhibition, obviously there's going to be a historical part of it, and that puts you into context and of what happened in those countries. But the rest of the exhibition is about vignettes that talk about people from our community, restaurants, part of the cities of the city that are important for us. And there's also the project.
There's this oral history and community archive project that we lead that's called What Travels Through Us. And it's basically a project that was inaugurated last year. Right now we're with the second cohort. And the objective of that project is to bridge the generational gap and help people from the second generation, or sometimes generation 1.5, to retrieve a bit of their family history. And so they're invited and guided in interviewing one of their family members and getting some piece of their family history, and then create a piece of art from that process. And so that first cohort, it took place last year, and there was an exhibit for it at Articule. And all of those pieces of art that were created in that context are here today in this exhibition as well. So it tells a bit of the story of generations kind of repairing their relationship to each other by telling the stories of their families.
So it's a mix of like the big history in a way, and also like just small stories that will construct our communities. So it's fun. There's a part that's artistic. There's a part that's more historical. So you get to learn things, but also like really feel emotions.
Yeah, and it helps us to feel more connected to our histories as well. And I think there's this general feeling in the exhibit too, that we recognize that small stories are history. And that like anecdotes, little fragments of things that were shared to us by our families, our parents, our grandparents, or sometimes even just members of the community who aren't a part of our like blood family, all of those little fragments form the histories that we may not be known for, but that we think are just as important as history with a big H, for example, and that's what we're highlighting today.
And are there any of those anecdotes or stories, anything you heard or you learned that, you know, has stayed with you that you think would be interesting, like something that made you laugh or like, you know, that you didn't know about before about your own community?
I have a fun story, actually. We were highlighting a restaurant called Au 14. It's on Prince Arthur. And it started with a grandma, and then her granddaughter bought the restaurant. And what I learned from it is that my father used to work for that lady back in the days. And he remembers the staff that were there. He remembers the current owner when she was a little girl. So that was crazy for me. Like, I wasn't expecting that at all.
Wow.
From that, like, part of the research.
So you went into the store and you said, not to be weird, but my dad actually met you when you were a kid?
Yeah, or? And I showed a picture of my dad, and she was like, who is that man?
Yeah, because it's harder to remember when you're the 5-year-old and not the grown-up. But that's amazing, yeah. And so I guess sort of to wrap it up, you spoke a little bit about what you want people from outside of these communities to take from the exhibition, but you've also said that you've invited members of these communities to come to the opening tonight. What's your message to some of these folks who came over on boats, elders that you talked to as part of the research and part of the oral history project? You know, what would you want to say to them?
I just want to say thank you so much, and I'm so proud of us, and I hope that everything that we put forward in the exhibition and everything that we do, I hope that the first generation understands that it's because we have come such a long way to come to love our cultures and love our history, and the reason we're using this exhibition to inaugurate our program for the 50th is really to honor everything that we've been through.
And we are back live in studio on CKUT. That was Maya Tran and Amy An Nguyen from the Superboat People Collective speaking about More Than Good Refugees, an exhibition that's on at the Centre des Mémoires Montréalaises until June 15th. Admission is free, and you can find more details online at MEMMTL. That's MEMMTL.ca. The last segment on our show is an interview that first aired 2 weeks ago to coincide with a lecture at McGill Law about unionizing prison labor. I'm resharing it now for anybody who missed it. This is Bread and Butter CKUT and a great conversation as well. Take a listen. More than 12,000 people are currently serving in federal prisons, and many are put to work in jobs in kitchens, maintenance, manufacturing, all for well under minimum wage. That's because prisoners are not legally recognized as employees, which means they lack the basic legal protections that other workers get. Jeff Ewart and Asaf Rashid are trying to change that. Ewart is president of the Canadian Prisoners Labor Confederation. They are working on a charter challenge to get federal prison workers unionized. Rashid is a criminal justice lawyer and co-author of the book Solidarity Beyond Bars. They stopped by CKUT on their way to speak at McGill Law's annual Prue Lecture to talk about the movement to unionize prison labor. Here's our conversation. You know, for people who might be surprised that we have a prison labor population in Canada, at the most basic level, you know, how common is it for somebody who is incarcerated to work a job in prison. You know, what is the actual state of prison labor in this country for listeners who might not know what's going on behind bars?
Well, as far as the federal prison population goes, most federal prisoners, and those are those who are serving sentences of at least 2 years, most actually work. They do some form of employment. And you think of, there's a couple of categories. One is basically institutional maintenance, and that is reproducing the prison. That's what I'll call it, where they're doing the cooking, the cleaning, the maintenance, and all other kinds of work that are day-to-day required that allow the prisons to function. And there's a whole other aspect of work in the federal prisons that's part of an operation called CORCAN, and that's the more business side of the Canadian prison labor industry, and they're doing production work. They're making textiles, furniture, doing other sorts of production work. During COVID-19, they made PPE, for example. Where do the products go that they make? They're purchased by other government departments. Prisoners are not recognized as employees. That's a legal category. What that means is that they don't have the basic protection of at least having a minimum wage, basic health and safety protections that cover all other employees. And very importantly, they don't have the right to unionize because they're not recognized as employees.
Jeff, you're one of the co-founders of CONFED, the Canadian Prisoners Labor Confederation. What was it in your own experience that made you want to start a prisoners union?
Well, it was not just the labor situation. It's everything to do with prison. Like, because prisoners live where we work, absolutely everything that we do is labor-related. Like, for example, you're sleeping and a guard shines a halogen flashlight in your face at 1 o'clock in the morning and wakes you up. Now you're tired at work and you go to work and you're working around a very dangerous pneumatic press that doesn't have proper safety features on it and you lose a piece of your finger. So prisoners have a lot of concerns about, like, the way they're treated, even just the way the guards talk to us. You know, like, there's a power differential that's unlike anything in modern society, and it's very dehumanizing and very demeaning. There's so many ways that it's abusive. That I was sitting with my friend there, David Jolivet, and we were talking about all these issues that affect us, and the idea just popped in my head. You know, we should form a union because we believe that would then balance the power, and just to be treated fairly, you know. Because if we weren't doing the jobs that we're doing, like mowing the lawn, shoveling the snow, cooking the food in the kitchens, cleaning the ranges, taking out the garbage, they'd have to have citizens come in and do those jobs, and they'd be paid a proper wage, and they would be called jobs. Their wages would be called wages, and their jobs would be called jobs. Our jobs are called participation in programs, and our wages are called an allowance to incentivize the participation in rehabilitative programs. But there's nothing rehabilitative about unplugging toilets or, you know, shoveling snow, really. I mean, I don't see that. What's rehabilitative is having self-worth and feeling like your work is meant something and means something. And also that prisoners, you know, they do decades in prison sometimes. And then they get out after making $5 a day for decades, which you can't buy much, and you put money on your phone card so you can phone your family. You got stamps and envelopes to keep in contact with your family, community ties. You don't have much left. You can't save for your release. You can't do that. And so guys are getting out of prison with nothing. What do? They turn back to crime. And that's what society should be concerned about, the atrocious recidivism rate in Canada. We're talking like the general recidivism rate, I think it's still like 86%. It's been static my entire sentence, which has been several decades. If CSC was correcting anything, one would expect the recidivism rate to be improving over all these years, but it doesn't. It just stays status quo. And I think the problem is that people are getting out with no job skills, no money, and they're resorting to crime and coming back. And it's, the whole thing's a mess. But if you taught people good job skills, paid them a proper wage, you're actually preparing them for release. And I think that would be the key. So that's where this came from.
And what are the kind of jobs that you've worked yourself when you were incarcerated? Can you tell me a bit day-to-day on the job? What are some things that you've experienced?
Well, I mean, I worked in the CORCAN Industries back before the Harper government took away the bonus pay and the incentive pay. The top pay level is $690 a day. So after your mandatory deductions, you're left with $52.50 after 10 days on $690. And the Harper government did all the cutbacks. I left, but before that, I was doing such things as making barriers for construction sites. So you take boards and then you hammer them together with this big mallet these little metal brackets with spikes in them that connect the... Anyways, it's really... A monkey could do it, okay? It's just brute force. You just do that all day, and it's just hard work. But it's not a skill. A lot of the stuff that people do in Corcan, a monkey could do. Literally, a monkey could do it. I've worked in printing operations where we printed file folders for various government departments. And guys are sitting at a table after the file folders are printed. They're folding the file folders and putting them in a box, putting those little, I don't know what you call them, those little metal tong things they stick through and to fasten them together, and then a white sticker on the back to hold it in place. And you just do this mundane thing all day long. It's not rehabilitative. It's very dehumanizing. It's demeaning. And it's very boring. But the RCMP file folder contract was $1.5 million. You know, I mean, they're making a lot of money off this. Like, we're subsidizing our own incarceration.
Both of you have spoken about the fact that, you know, prisoners are not getting the same protections as other workers. Why, I guess, in our legal regime, are prisoners not treated as employees? I understand why it might make sense to get subsidized labor in a prison if you're looking at, you know, the dollars and cents of it. But how did we get to this point where you can be doing work and not be considered a worker?
From my experience, the Correctional Service of Canada gets more and more sophisticated the more challenges there are in court. And there was a case some time ago. It was a fellow that was, he was trying to be a CSIS employee. He was in the program. He did his, you know, he did his firearms training. He did his hand-to-hand combat training. Now he's in languages training, and he's got to complete this last thing before he can be a CSIS employee. And he applied to be a member of the union. And the ruling was, you cannot be a member of a union if you're in a program. And around that time, CSC changed the name of the work board to the programs board.
CSC being?
Correctional Service of Canada. So now we have a programs board. And they changed the name. We're not working. We're involved in rehabilitative programs. So it's semantics, right? So then they say, and our pay isn't pay. There's a whole CD, a commissioner's directive on inmate pay. It's called inmate pay. That's what the CD is called. But yet, when it comes to these legal challenges, the Treasury Board argues it's not pay. It's an allowance to incentivize the participation in the said rehabilitative programs. Now, there are rehabilitative programs. I don't know how much rehabilitation takes place in these programs, but these are like therapeutic interventions. It's completely different than what the work we do. Mopping a floor does not do that. Shoveling snow does not do it. Mowing the grass does not. Folding file folders doesn't do that. But it has been shown that, because back in the day, prior to all this nonsense, people actually had real good jobs in prison. There was welding. Guys could get welding tickets. They could, you know, they could learn plumbing, how to do plumbing stuff. They could get tickets. And they got out and they did really well. There was even auto mechanics. They'd have a car in there and people would be like taking apart engines and putting it back together again. Like you could learn a skill that is employable in the community. And these guys weren't coming back. And then it all changed. They got into this, the whole philosophy of corrections and what they're trying to do with people, rehabilitate them, you know?
You said under the Harper government around 2013, the structure of prisoner pay changed. Is that when you and your friend at the time decided to launch these legal challenges?
No, it was way before that. Although the legal challenge happened in 2014, it was just a coincidence. David Joel Levitt and I had these discussions in 2004 in Mission Institution. And then we both got involuntarily transferred out of the institution for different reasons. I'm not saying there were good reasons, but we were both transferred out. I went to a maximum security penitentiary. He went to a medium security penitentiary. And I sort of forgot about it, you know, because we're not together now. And, you know, I'm in a max and it's really tight there. And he was in this medium. But he kept the idea in his head and he started talking to people about it and started kind of getting some momentum behind it. And he contacted me and I said, okay. So I started writing the constitutions. Right, because you got to have a constitution if you're going to file an unfair labor practices complaint. And then there was a riot in the institution he was in, and somebody got murdered, and he got shipped out. He came to where I was, so we were back together again. And that's when we started, about 2009, that's when that happened. He came back to Kent, Max. So we started putting it together, and we asked the warden for permission to have a meeting, a general population meeting in the gym, and for the purpose of organizing. And of course, they said no, and that's a violation of a charter, Section 2D, Freedom of Association. So we filed an unfair labor practices complaint before what was then called the Public Service Labor Relations Board.
And so since then, you have been filing various legal complaints, building up this case that now
is taking the form of a charter challenge. Is that right? Can you tell me more about where your legal challenge stands today, what you're trying to do in 2025, you know, more than 15 years after you guys started working on this union?
Okay, so 2012, I wrote written submissions to the PSLRB on the first unfair labor practices complaint. And of course, we were denied. And I told Dave, we're going to be denied, we're going to lose, and we're going to lose in federal court. And in 2014, I argued what was then called Jolivet versus Treasury Board, because he was the front guy. And of course, that was before the Federal Court of Appeal, and we lost. But what I told Dave is we're going to attract lawyers. And that, at that time, a law firm called Cavalluzzo, Shilton, McIntyre & Cornish in Toronto, so a very large labor law firm, contacted me. Dave, he disappeared. He got out in 2012, and I haven't heard from him since. So they've been with me for the past 11 years now, pro bono. They believe in this. And there's a good lawyer down there, Ryan White, and his associate, Deborah Gruderman, and they're working very hard. And yeah, we went before the board. The Treasury Board is the respondent, because that's who runs and operates CORCAN. That's where our money comes from. We're paid by the Treasury Board. And there's a provision in the Act that says if you work for the Crown, you can't be a member of a union, if I'm correct. So that same provision prevented the RCMP from unionizing. And then they did a charter challenge and they won. So ironically, it looks like the RCMP have paved the way for us.
So you guys are doing a charter challenge too. What is it in the charter that you are using to contest this?
Well, the main charter argument that used universally with these types of things is 2D, freedom of association. But there's a couple others I've been talking with Ryan and Deborah about. There's one section 6.2b. Under 6 is the freedom of mobility, the right for a citizen to move anywhere in the province of Canada, take up residence in any province of Canada. But section 6.2b says every citizen of Canada has the right to earn a livelihood. And so that, nobody's argued this before because people who work earn a livelihood. But we work, but we can't earn a livelihood at $5 a day. And we can't help our families, and we can't prepare ourselves for release. So I suggested to Ryan and Deborah that we look at adding that charter argument.
And yeah, you talked about filing these challenges from behind bars. What was that like, just to, you know, start out, you and your friend, without any lawyers as of yet? You said you got this pro bono legal support after coming out with these challenges, but you still had to like figure out how the legal system worked and like go through the complex and arduous task over years of starting this process. What was that like, and what is it like now to be doing this constitutional challenge with that support that you got by putting forward all these different board challenges over the years?
You know, it was necessary. It was necessary to learn because, again, we don't make much money, so we don't have the money to hire lawyers. If you're getting $5 a day, you can barely buy a bag of chips at the end of your pay period after you paid for your cable and everything else and your family needs and stuff, like your phone calls and stuff. So if you're going to complain about something, do something about it. And so I just hit the books and started trying to learn how to navigate my way through federal court. And yeah, that's where we got. You have to do it because they're not going to do it for you. Lawyers aren't just going to come running to you and say, well, I'll do this case for nothing. So I just had to learn how to do it myself. And that's where it started for me. It's been weird.
Asaf, I want to ask you, what support is there for this kind of initiative in Canada? You argued that prisoners need unionization in your book. When you were doing the research for that book, what did you find about just what precedents are there and what kind of, I guess, movement this could be a part of?
Well, there was an actual union of prisoners back in the late 70s and early 80s at the Guelph. There's a Guelph Correctional Center, provincial prison in Guelph. They were abattoir workers, and they worked alongside non-incarcerated workers, and they were together in a union. And that lasted for a number of years. So that's the only example in Canadian history where prisoners were actually unionized and is in a provincial setting. But as far as right now, like what the issue is, why should people care? Well, the thing is, there's this mistaken kind of identification of prisoners as somehow being entirely separate from the rest of society, that they don't have any connection with others, including other workers, in fact, not even recognized as employees. Well, actually, there are a lot of others who face a similar situation where they are treated quite horribly in society, such as, for example, migrant farm workers under the seasonal agricultural workers program. They are forced to live on the site of their employer. They are on closed work permits. And if they have a problem with their boss can just fire them and then they get deported. So there are other workers who are in a very vulnerable situation. So we're arguing in the book that people should see commonality between other groups of workers who are also on very marginalized positions and prisoners. There's also a lot of other workers who have not had employee recognition either. We think of gig economy workers. They were told you're independent contractors, not employees. So this is another group of workers who also they've been denied the category of employee recognition. Therefore, without that category, they're not protected by basic minimum employment standards, being treated like an independent contractor, as if they're running their own business. Therefore, they get underpaid, they get poorly treated, etc. There's also unpaid interns in Canada as well. It's a huge problem. This was supposed to have been banned in Canada. That was talked about in 2015. The federal government talked about banning unpaid internships. They didn't ban them. So what we want to see is drawing the lines between other groups of workers and prisoners for something called an inclusive labor movement. So people should care about this, especially now when it's more important perhaps than ever for the labor movement to be more organized as we're facing all these tariff threats, which with the likely consequences of the Canadian state seeking to find ways to increase corporate profits. So we'll be seeing pressures to lower wages, even we're going to see cutting of social programs, an austerity agenda rollout, and that's going to put a lot of pressure on workers, particularly lower-income workers, and it's going to be more and more important to be organized to fight back against that. And you can't have workers who are not even considered employees or denied the right to unionization. That's not going to help when it comes to the labor movement needing to fight back as strong as ever.
I think it's important that we succeed in this, because I think it would be inspirational for other people in other situations, like the migrant workers, like these other workers that we've been discussing, to see that even lowly prisoners can get their act together and fight against this monstrosity, which is government oppression, and win. And I think if we win, I think that'll inspire others to say, hey, you know, we can do this too. And I think that would help. I think it would really. So root for us, get behind us and support us. We'll support you.
To sort of close off, I wanted to ask you both, what is really at stake here? You know, how would this change people's lives, specifically the lives of people who are incarcerated, if this case succeeds?
There's a really crucial piece of prisoner unionization where if prisoners were successful, and I think in this case, I have hope that they will be this time around, that what will end up happening is that you will have the fact of unionization, and that would mean that prisoners would have the right to sit across a bargaining table with the employer. Who's the employer? Well, it's Correctional Service of Canada in the case of federal prisons. It's not just their employer, it's also their jailer. So it opens the door to a whole number of other issues. The living conditions and the working conditions are inseparable. It gives the opportunity to bring a lot to the table. And it could be a game changer in terms of power dynamics, because you suddenly have the protection of labor law. This charter, Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, power to compel the government to negotiate in good faith. And it has to be meaningful collective bargaining. There are all these terms that apply to all employees across the country when they're unionized. And you'd have the Correctional Service of Canada being stuck having to deal with that legal weight that's behind the power to sit at a bargaining table across from them, as prisoners will be doing. So the possibilities are enormous in terms of what can be gained, even the possibility of better work programs to be able to be in a better position to be released and stay out. Possibly it could lead to even decarceration, because you'll have prisoners needing to get paid more, being treated better, becomes more costly for the prisons to maintain large populations. If people are doing well and being paid well in their jobs in prison, perhaps say they could be on a road to quicker release, because the government simply can't afford to keep them in for much longer.
So a lot could change, basically. Jeff, what are you hoping will change?
Everything's going to change. This is going to be, like, as you said, a game changer. I just wanted to point out that we're not the only ones on the panel tonight. There's going to be the co-author of the book, Solid Liberty Beyond Bars. His name is Jordan House. He's a professor of labor law studies at Brock University. There's going to be correctional investigator Ivan Zinger. There's going to be Deborah Gudeman. She's a lawyer out of Cavaluzzo that I referred to earlier. And then, of course, our host and moderator, Professor Jeff Kennedy. So there'll be six of us on the panel. It's my understanding, and I'm new at this, I've never been involved in any union activities. We haven't succeeded yet, so it's not a union yet. But it's my understanding that it's illegal to interfere with the lawful activities of a union. So once we are a union, if we're doing something lawfully, you cannot interfere with us. And if you interfere with us, then a mediator can be brought in from the labor board, and we can, as he said, collectively bargain and negotiate for changes or improvements, right? And it changes the whole conversation. The inmate grievance procedure that we presently have, I hate that word inmate, but that's what they call it. Oh no, they changed it. They call it offender complaint. I hate that name too. Complaint and grievance system is absolutely useless. It's a waste of money and time, and it's designed to frustrate prisoners so they just give up. That will be gone. We form a union. Our disputes will be dealt with in an adult fashion with professional people that are actually good at what they do, and it'll be fair. So that's a big one. Prisoners, there's a lot of prisoners that want to give back to society. We've taken from society, and some of us feel bad about that. Not everybody, but some of us do, and we want to give back. And this is a way to do it. It's not well known, but our Constitution has a provision for a victims' assistance fund. See, prisoners who get out of prison, they have a parole condition, almost universally a parole condition, no contact, direct or indirect, with your victims or your families or your victims. So say, for example, a prisoner gets out and wins the lottery. He can't even do anything to help out the families of his victims because that would be a violation of his release conditions, and he could be revoked and brought back to prison. But if we had a general labor union victims fund, and there was, you know, some coffers there that the board of directors of the union would decide on their own who they're going to help out, it would be independent of any prisoners, and nobody would be violating any conditions. So say, for example, some woman, she's a single mother, and her car gets stolen, and she can't get to work, and she can't drop her kids off. And this hits the news, and it's a sad story, but it's, you know, the local news. And the board of directors of our union says, you know what, let's help that woman out. And they just make a decision to give her $30,000 for a car, or 10, or whatever it is for a car. I don't know what cars cost these days. These kinds of things. This is something that would be really good. But also, we'd be paying into workmen's compensation, so we could have compensation for our injuries. We'd be paying taxes, income taxes. We pay sales taxes on what we purchase, but we can't collect tax rebates because we don't pay income tax. Because we don't get income, we get incentives for participation in programs, right? We'd be paying into, like, registered retirement savings plans. So if we got out, we could actually do that. We'd be paying EI,